Okay, my friend, so here you are now. This should be CD number 3 in the Drama of the Gifted Child series. Again, please forgive any of the mechanical mishaps. But I'm glad we're able to do this for you.
Hi, everybody, it's Armand DeMille back with you with The Positive Mind every Wednesday at 1 p.m. And today we're going to continue to look at what we shrinks call the dynamics of narcissistic personality functioning. One of those names that Alan Watts talks about with a particular emphasis on one aspect that seems to confuse people. Today we're going to talk about the wound that doesn't heal. The pain that won't go away. Now, for the last 2 weeks, we've been covering the subject of the narcissistic self, which means, in case you haven't been listening, to be attached to the false self that each of us developed in early childhood to get the love and approval of our parents. Right? When we were kids, we developed a self so that our parents would like us, whether or not we felt that way. So narcissism means to be attached to that false self that each of us developed in early childhood to get the love and approval of our parents. And today, I'm going to wind up this series by covering 3 of the most important pitfalls of living the narcissistic life. Today, we're going to talk about, first, the narcissistic wound. And then later, we'll talk about grandiosity and depression. But the narcissistic wound, the pain that won't go away, that's what we're going to cover. What it is, why it is, what to do about it, how to take advantage of it. Do you ever wonder why somebody you love suddenly turned you off or turned off to you? Or a close friend who suddenly started talking to you like you were on the other side of the wall? Or especially if you're in a helping profession, do you ever wonder why your patients or clients or customers, whatever you call them, go away and don't come back? The answer is the narcissistic wound. This series, which I call The Drama of the Gifted Child, started 3 weeks ago. And if you'd like to receive copies of the last 2 shows, you can call my office. I think this is great stuff. And I can truthfully say that this understanding is a great part of why I'm relatively successful in my own life. But before I go into that, I have to keep a promise. About 3 weeks ago, I mentioned what it was like for me to be a teacher and a lecturer, confronting my own grandiose narcissistic ego, especially back in 1987, which does not mean that it's not there now. And I mentioned my lecture jokes. Well, all week I've been getting requests for the next in my series of lecture jokes. I have favorites that I use from place to place that usually fit the audience and start the internal journal of self-curiosity. I love to engender that in people, you know, so the joke is more than a joke. This one's dedicated to Carolyn, the heirloom dress restorer. Here's my 3rd favorite that I usually told if I sensed that the audience was a complaining audience, the kind of folks who tend to use mutual complaining as a way of making contact with each other. This is called the somebody up there joke. I tell it with the help of my dear friend, Matthew Finch. Now, it relates to a subject as well as the title of the program, The Positive Mind. I've told you on air about a year ago, so forgive me, my friends, for the repeat. Here it is now. It's a story about a man who throughout his life was faced with the disasters of nature. And when he was born, a cyclone hit the hospital, and he got swooped up and deposited 3 miles away from where he was born, where he was found and put in a foundling home. He grew up without parents and wound up in an orphanage, where he was finally adopted by some farmers. He worked the farm most of his early years, but then he met someone, fell in love, and asked her to marry him. In preparation for this wedding, final happiness, he bought his own house, which, the day after closing the deal, was caught in a mudslide and destroyed. Which reminds me of another true story. Wait, before I continue my joke, you know, back in 1987, when I took that Find My True Self almost a year hiatus, I'll get back to the joke. I was living in a remote community of Fire Island in a small shack that I had rented. I saw a house by the ocean. It was for sale. It was beautiful. It was all stone on a high spot facing the ocean. Now remember, this was my time of not working, not creating, not doing, looking at myself and trying to understand who I really was instead of who my false self was. And there stood this beautiful little house facing the ocean, and it was winterized. It seemed like it was meant to, for me, you know, big sign for sale. So I spoke to the owner, who said that her psychologist, of all things, husband, had just died, and that the house was filled with too many painful memories, so she wanted to sell it. And she wanted to sell it relatively cheaply. Now, it was $200,000, which sounds like an enormous amount of money, but it had a tiny down payment and a very small mortgage over 20 years, and I actually could have afforded it. And it even had automatic federal flood insurance, so it kind of looked perfect. It was like a dream. Now, it didn't fit into my Buddhist dedication to be simple for a while, but you know Buddhism. You can make anything nothing with enough rationalizing. So I went for it. Told her I wanted the house. Then the owner said, I can't just do it yet. I need a few days to make peace with the idea of selling it. And I understood. So I told her, I'll be back in a couple of weeks, and I'll be back with it next week, I said. And we'll deal with it then. And she said, okay, I'll be ready by next week. Guess what happened? October 1987, Hurricane Gloria. In one fell swoop, the house was taken to the ocean. It was gone. The owner had evacuated. She was fine. The insurance covered everything for her. She got all her money. I had never even given her a deposit. Gone, the entire house, right into the ocean. I went back to contemplating my neighbor. Who's the trickster up there? You know? Well, let's get back to our story. Story about this unfortunate guy. So he loses his house, and he got to his car, and then he goes to his car. You know, his house gets caught in a mudslide, and he gets down to his car, but an earthquake happens and swallows up his car. And his bride-to-be got swept away by a flood, only to be saved by a sailor, with whom she immediately fell in love and married him instead. So he tried to start over, but his next farm suffered a drought. And even when he finally got a place in the mountains, a never-before-happened volcanic eruption took his new house away. He was punchy and decided that the land was too dangerous for him, and he decided to go to sea. He went out to sea. He got a job on a tramp steamer in the South Pacific. And what do you think happens? He's in the South Pacific on this steamer trying to work along, and in the South Pacific, his ship gets hit by an iceberg. Everybody else on the ship is picked up, and they didn't see him. And there he was, in the middle of the ocean, floating on a log that was being eaten by termites. And the log got smaller and smaller, he noticed, and off in the distance, a gigantic tidal wave was heading his way. Closer than that, the log all dissolved, you know, the termites having eaten it. A whirlpool started pulling him under. By the way, he couldn't swim. And he saw the big fins of a school of sharks coming right at him. He started to get pulled under as the tidal wave closed in and the sharks got closer. He sank for the second time as the wave was beginning to loom closer and he could begin to see the big teeth of the sharks now circling him. He was going down for the third time as the tidal wave was about to crunch down on him and the sharks were closing in for the kill. And he looked up to heaven and he said, oh God, this is it. I know this is the end, but before I die, answer one question. Why me? Why me? Every day of my life, everything that happened on earth, all acts of God, over and over again, more than my share. I got everybody's share. Why me? As he went down for the last time, and the sharks closed their bite on him, and the tidal wave crashed on top of him. And suddenly, out of the heavens, a basket drifted from the sky, and hanging from the basket was his answer, which was written on this ribbon, which said, because something about you just pisses me off. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind every Wednesday at 1 p.m. Hope you enjoyed that. I got a big kick out of it. Are you going to kick out of that, Matthew? Without Matthew Finch. So I'm telling my stories here on BAI and talking about narcissism, grandiosity, and depression and how it relates to our day-to-day existence and how it relates to our feeling of success and failure. I'm focusing on this one part of the narcissistic life, and that's the pain that seems to last forever. what we in the profession call the narcissistic wound. We're going to be taking your calls in a little while, and later I'm going to try to get to another aspect of narcissism, which is depression. But for the last 2 weeks, we've covered the trappings of narcissism and spoke with a few of you. I may be able to get back to you today. If I don't, David, please accept my apologies, and to the rest of you, we're going to try. And before I go any further, a brief review. Remember, narcissism is not self-love. That's the way it's used. That's not what it is. It is this false self that we create to please other people. And we take that character and keep it with us for the rest of our lives. We're looking for the love and approval of our parents. We're looking to earn it. They make it conditional. And we're trying to get it, so we keep trying to please or trying to get recognition just so that we can have this false self kind of taken care of. You learn that certain emotions and feelings like anger and need are not acceptable, so you got to bury them. And if you're really unfortunate, you lose all sense of your own identity and become most, like most people do, you become what society wants you to be. And remember, the self that's developed with the sole purpose, this self is developed with the sole purpose of getting love and approval, which can come in any form, acceptance, recognition, all of that. That self, the one we adopt to get love and approval in the world, that self is called the narcissistic self. So, narcissism is the attachment to our love-getting self. Now, somewhere, each of us suspects that our act is a phony. In some way, we don't feel real. For good reason, because we're not. Because we've buried our real feelings. We get caught in the trap of needing love and admiration because the love we got in childhood was fake love, because it was conditional love. When you really love a kid, it's not conditional. The kid feels that you love. Even if you disapprove of the kid still feels the love. But the way most parents play it is they pull back the love. They show you anger instead. So everything we do, every choice we make, every profession, education, marriage, and even the decision to have children, all to feed the false self, the narcissistic self, looking to be loved and accepted. So that's the review. Now let's take it one more place. Did you ever have something happen to you that knocked you for a loop for years? Something that happened that was in itself, as tragedies go, not so big? But it seemed to take the heart right out of you. It seemed to rip the soul right out of your body. It was a pain as deep as you can get. A reality that almost made you want to kill yourself, or something that made you so rageful you considered killing someone else. Let me give you an example. A man I know was in love and living with his perfect mate. She was a dancer. He was a psychotherapist, actually, working in New York. They moved to a beach town because they just wanted to be together. Where they got married. He had been a playboy in the past, but now he was 100% in love, monogamous. He was head over heels in love, so was she. He gave up his profession as a psychotherapist because he didn't want to come to New York. He became a bartender. She still danced and traveled a little bit. He was as happy as a person could be, solid, calm. The guy had kind of gotten all the things that you want. Then she had a dance engagement in South America where she encountered her old boyfriend from a long time ago and decided that she was really in love with him and he was her true love, and she ran off with him. He, this man, a very happy, solid guy usually, fell into a dull depression, moved to Florida, and did nothing but get stoned for 3 years. Right? He couldn't take it. This one was beyond his ken. Another man I know, a real estate broker, you know, pretty solid guy, engaged to a woman who breaks off with him because she heard Jesus in her prayers tell him that their marriage was not right. His reaction? Prolonged depression. A bright, intelligent woman gets turned down for a promotion at work. Her reaction? Prolonged rage that won't quit. She's now angry all the time. Someone's purse is stolen. Reaction? Prolonged feeling of despair. Someone dies, and you feel like half of you is gone forever, and you can't recover. Why such severe reactions? Clearly, in each case, it's a bad thing. But that's life. This is what life is about. Why such a severe reaction that you can't kick? Why do we react so severely to certain things and not to others? Why do people we know suddenly turn off or hate us or have severe reactions also? The answer, my friends, is something called the narcissistic wound. Now, the problem with living an image self is that you believe that if you follow all the rules, if you do whatever is necessary to get the love and attention, it has to work eventually, or it must work. The narcissistic person, especially the grandiose narcissist, the performer, the leader, the one that's bent on success, the radio personality, you know, the artist, the writer, absolutely believes that if they do everything right, they must eventually get love in return, and that could come in the form of recognition or getting hired or a book contract. Remember, last week I said narcissism can take one of two ways. Either you become grandiose, which means that you're out there trying for success and recognition, believing that you can get loved if you just do the right thing. You know, like the model who starves herself, who's bulimic, who sacrifices relationship because she's looking for everybody to see her as beautiful so that maybe one day she can feel loved, but she needs the whole world to love her or a magazine to love her. Or the men and women who attach themselves to abusive partners. They're sure that if they love enough, and if they give everything, he or she might love them in return and stop being abusive. That's a pattern straight from childhood, you know. If your mother or father is angry, and if you just do the right things, they're going to stop getting mad. That idea, that proper performance guarantees love, comes straight from that conditional love childhood. Mommy and daddy told you that if you were good, they would love you. And they did. What looked like love. Now, I'm not blaming mommy and daddy. I mean, this is what everybody grew up with. And repeated. Why wouldn't you believe that it works that way? You know, either you become grandiose, or you set up a belief, usually in early childhood, that no matter what you do, nobody will ever love you. That's one of the decisions some people make, and that's what the root of depression is, the belief that you're not good enough to be loved. We'll get to depression later. If not today, the next show we do, but I'm going to try to get to that as well. But the problem here is that the narcissistic person is living in an unreal world, that they are living this false, created-for-love image self. Got that? And just in case you forgot, this is Armand DeMille with you, with The Positive Mind, every Wednesday at 1 o'clock, doing a series called The Drama of the Gifted Child, based on the work of Alice Miller, a psychiatrist. Just stuff that I think has been important, that's helped me an enormous amount in my life. So it's back to the issue. What happens when someone bursts your bubble? What happens when someone in some way or other does something that proves to you that you are not so special, that your manipulations don't work, that you can't get love, that this false image of ours doesn't work? It's an amazing thing. It's like the snake with the dead outer skin that everybody, including you, thinks is a real snake, you know? The real you. Then somebody comes along and ignores that skin. They don't respond to your act. They won't love you, accept you, or approve of you in one way or another, in some symbolic way. And that's what a narcissistic wound is. How can that be? Your whole sense of self is dependent on your outer skin being believed. You're a nutritionist who has someone telling you that you don't know what you're talking about, or you're a doctor whose patient gets angry because they got worse instead of better. You're a customer and you get cheated by a salesperson. How could they cheat me? I'm such a good person. You're a gifted girlfriend who finds a stain on your boyfriend's sheet that doesn't belong there. When you suffer a narcissistic wound, the initial response is usually shock, disbelief. Next usually is a feeling of panic. So first is a shock, then there's like a suspended feeling, then comes this feeling of minor panic, and then you feel a mixture of a sinking feeling and an outrage at the very same time. So you're sinking down and you feel outrage at the same time. And then, according to who you are, you'll either get rageful, deeply depressed, or you'll disconnect yourself from the source of pain completely, as if they don't exist. Now, sometimes the wound is subtle. It's a wince that goes deep, but gets covered up fast for the moment. Like when you're in therapy and your therapist gets annoyed at you for blaming them that you keep picking the wrong partners, and your therapist gets defensive and says something subtle like, well, I don't know if you are looking for a successful relationship. You don't know, you aren't always the nicest person, you know? And they wound you. It's subtle. You get angry, but since in life in general you're not honest with your emotions, you rationalize, well, they must be right. But something inside you knows that this person, this therapist, is starting to get real with you. So you act nice, but forget the next appointment. And then suddenly figure out the therapy's costing you too much and you need new clothing for the spring so you can't afford it. Meanwhile, the therapist who went into the profession originally because he or she desperately needed to have someone love and admire them, right? Then they realize that the forgotten appointment the client may be resisting, but doesn't act on it or challenge it because they don't want to face the fact that somebody doesn't love them and that their outer skin isn't working. So the therapist accepts the excuse, and then when the patient cancels over the issue of money and spring clothing and won't come back, the therapist suffers the narcissistic wound, the crack in the image-loving self, and they respond to themselves by saying, the client really didn't want to get better. You know, they blame the client. Believe me, I've supervised a lot of health professionals, and one thing is for sure, health professionals have very frail narcissistic egos. So that's the story about narcissistic wounds, and I want to show you how to uncover these moments, and for that, I'm going to go to the phones. And here's my question. Did you ever have a time when an incident happened that you couldn't get over? Something that wounded your image of yourself? That's the question I ask you. 2793400 is our number here. Report to me the incidents of when you recognized a wound to your image of yourself, when you found out that the thing you thought, you were such a big shot, and you thought you were such a big shot, and then somebody did something, and you just couldn't get over it. 2793400. We're going to take your calls, or maybe you know somebody who has shut you out completely and you can't understand it. A customer or somebody you know or a friend who's kind of suddenly put up a wall with you. Almost all of these separations, lost business, you know, people who don't ever want to call you again, people who don't want to be in touch with you, you've wounded them somehow. Or when you suddenly feel that the switch goes off and you don't love anybody anymore, you know, that you used to like them so much and then suddenly it's turned off, that's a narcissistic wound. I'll help you identify it. Once you identify it, it's very easy to recover. 2793400. We're going to take one of these callers right now. Hi there, this is Armand DeMille. You're on the air.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
I'm thinking back to when I was in my early 20s, and my mother, I guess, was feeling a little guilty about something she had done to me when I was young. I had no recollection of it, but she had told me that when I was little, I was primping in front of a mirror. You know how little girls do about 5 years old?
Uh-huh.
And she had told me that I was ugly and shouldn't be doing that.
Uh-huh.
She was afraid I would grow up conceited, is what she told me, and actually, I would have been happier if she never even mentioned it, because I had no memory of it.
Okay.
Now I'm in my 30s, and every time I'm feeling down or, you know, down on myself, maybe about the way I look, that memory comes right back into my head.
All right, now you believe, you get down on yourself about the way you look, because you believe you have to have this outside skin that people have to be attracted to, right? And it's got to be somewhat perfect?
Always perfect, yes.
Always perfect, right?
Yes, I have that kind of...
Tell me about the kind of things you do to make yourself perfect. How many times do you look in a mirror during the day?
I'm not very concerned about how I look now, but I try to do it in other ways. Like
you remember the day?
Every time I play, I have to be perfect. I'm an artist. Mm-hmm. I won't do it on a piece of work. If it's not perfect, I'll rip it up.
Okay, so let's say you're an artist and you're a musician, and you're playing something and it has to be perfect, and suddenly you can't play it. You can't get it, right?
Right.
Or you do something in public. And you make a mistake. Have you ever done that?
Oh, yes.
All right? And it hits you. It hits you like a truck. Because you are trying to protect this image. You're playing that piano to get mommy to love you.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Exactly.
And then, because it's so tense, because this whole false self is based on getting the love, is what I think you're saying, that there's a real self inside that could probably play for herself.
Right.
Not for her mommy.
Yeah.
Where are you now?
Well, where am I now?
Yeah.
I'm home.
You're home? You got a piano?
Yes.
Where? Is it sitting anywhere around?
Yeah.
Play something for me.
Oh, no, you're kidding.
No, I'm serious. Play something for me and make a mistake.
Oh, okay, I'll try to play.
Okay, bring the phone over. I hope she's bringing the phone over. Are you near the telephone? Can you hear me?
Well, I made a mistake.
I know, you made a mistake. Hey, could you bring the phone a little closer to the piano?
It's kind of impossible.
Is it kind of impossible?
I don't have an extension on my phone here.
Do you have a gentle, could you play Satie or something like that? You play something really gentle, because I want to read something, and I need you to play for me in the background.
Oh, boy.
What's real gentle? Chopin?
I have Chopin right here. I can play the lullaby, a little bit of it anyhow.
Okay, could you play the lullaby in the background?
Mm-hmm.
And I want to read one poem before we go off the air, and then we're going to come back after our break. But I want to read a poem, and I need a little music in the background. It's a poem about a person who talks about the inside of themselves, and I just need a little gentle music.
Okay, I have a couple ideas. I'll go over by the piano.
Okay, you go over by the piano.
All right,
and listen, you're going to call my office, and you're going to get a copy of this tape as a gift from me because I want you to hear us together.
Oh, boy.
And make a mistake. I mean, be sure to make a mistake, because if you make a mistake, it's okay by me.
Okay.
All right? What's your first name? Oh, that's right. She went to the piano. Let me read you something that was given to me by a social worker who talks about a thing about the hidden feelings inside and talks about what it's like to live with this, with the secrets inside. This poem is called The Me Inside Me. We're just waiting for a piano cue. This is Armand DeMille with you every Wednesday at 1 p.m. with the Positive Mind. You know the thing about the narcissistic wound? I'll never forget what Anita Reisenberg once said. She said, never take away someone's dignity. Meaning, never wound their narcissistic self. Because dignity is kind of that narcissistic self, you know? Never take it away. Never strip it away from someone. Let's see if my friend is up there on the piano yet. No, it's going to start any minute now. I know. I've got patience.
You are listening to The Positive Mind with Armand DeMille on WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial.
Here we go. This is called The Me Inside Me. It was harbored deep within, hidden from view, long accustomed to burial within the funeral folds of shame and guilt. Any call to come forth sent tremors of terror into the darkened chambers where a stone had been rolled to seal off entry. My pain erupted in a firework display of emotions, confusion, anger, fear, retreating from the reach of hands, blocking any trespasser's attempt to explore such sacred terrain. The morning shroud was not easily untangled. It seemed a monumental task to even think of rolling the stone aside. It might have only taken a look of acceptance, of acquittal, a soothing balm after years of silent bondage, but could such a look be believed? Could we but travel together to the door of the pain-laden space, surmount the wall, and render it unnecessary? Journey with the halting steps of infant trust to a safe place? At last, to learn it had taken all this, the tears and wanting life to end, continual efforts to make the naked feeling of exposure, to come where a friend openly gazes upon that which once had struggled so hard to shield from view. To shield from view and to see the beauty of the real me inside me.
Hello.
Hi there.
I forgot to ask you how long I was supposed to play.
You did beautifully.
Okay,
right,
thanks.
To the second. What's your name?
My name is Donna.
Donna, thanks for sharing this with me.
All right, I just have one other thing to tell you, and it just,
sure.
It's funny, when I was playing it, it came back to me. Besides that other incident I told you about, one at my second or third piano recital, I hit the wrong chord when I started my piece, and I stopped for a minute and then continued on, and I looked up at my father, and he gave me a thumbs down.
Oh.
You know, I always wanted to be a music major, and I would never do it.
Oh, my God.
I would never go. I don't even think he knew what it did to me.
Hey, you know what I'm doing right now?
No.
Thumbs up to you.
Oh, the little damages we do. Even with a thumbs down, huh? This is Armand DeMille with you. I'm back with you, of course. Now, while I'm making this CD out of the old cassette, and I find that there's a little gap in time here between the cassette and the end of the cassette, so I'm going to fill it in with a little wisdom. Like, why do we listen to... Why do we listen to callers, you know? What do you get from that? I hope you get the compassion and the understanding for these other beings. Who are you, in effect? I think we learn as we listen, number one. Number two, if you're impatient with it, of course you could always try to skip through and find what I'm saying in between. But I think it's important to hear the callers. Remember, we're all living an image of who we think we should have been to get the love that we wanted as a child. We are all living an image of who we thought we should be in order to get the love we needed. As a child, we created an image like those 300 people who think that they're funny. We're like that, you know? We just took it on. We're going to be one way or another just to be able to get eventually the love that we needed. Armand DeMille with you. The music you're listening to, Dreams of Children by Shadowfax, given to us by Chuck Greenberg, who's playing the flute right now, as you listen, who died a few years ago, but before he died, felt completely honored that we were using his music as theme music. So I'll use it. Here's to you, Chuck. So, my friends, you can either listen to the rest of this music, or if you're in a hurry, fast forward.
Hi there, this is Armand DeMille back with you at The Positive Mind, part three of The Drama of the Gifted Child, The Wounds That Won't Heal, talking to people and trying to teach you a little bit about the narcissistic wound. 279-3400, we're going to take a couple of more callers before I go on to talk about depression. Hi there, this is Armand DeMille, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, I can't believe I got on.
Yeah, I know, it's hard, isn't it? You were just waiting and waiting.
Yeah. I'm really enjoying your program, and I'm wondering if you might be able to help me figure something out.
Sure.
Okay. I am basically a creative person, and I actually have degrees in being creative, in creative writing. And I find it really strange at this particular moment in my life that really what I do for a living, and I have been really quite absorbed in, is financial and numerical concerns.
Uh-huh.
And my mother really did not want me to do anything creative at all. She was very threatened by that. And at one point, I had created a certain amount of success in terms of, you know, things to do with school and scholarships.
Okay, so let me explain to you. Just because your mother didn't want you to do anything creative doesn't mean that the creativity is not based on trying to get the love and attention of our mothers. You see, we do whatever we could do to try to get the love and attention, not just because our parents approved of us. Very often it is. But sometimes you just figure, boy, if I write and I become famous, or if I write and people get to know me, or if I write and I get the recognition, then I'm going to fill that empty hole, that thing that was there by the missing love that I had in my childhood. And maybe not only from your mom. What about your dad? Where was he?
My father died, and I have a stepfather.
Uh-huh. And how did you feel about your father's death? Do you remember it?
No, not really.
Mm-hmm.
The only memory I have is seeing my father beat my mother up.
Uh-huh. I understand. So none of it is kind of nice. You know, your house was a house that was empty of real love, right? And you had to kind of take care of yourself growing up.
Actually, what I had to do is I had to remove myself from my environment and in some ways recreate myself so that I could leave.
I understand. So you had to remove yourself completely and you had to develop a skin that would function on the outside. You know? But now...
And bring myself somewhere else, because basically the person who I was not going to be suitable for the environment that I found myself in.
And are you still not suitable for the environment that you're in? Are you an isolate?
I feel like I'm in exile all the time. I'm able to...
Are you someone who works mostly at home with her computers?
Yeah, and I deal with other people, and I have to.
Are you dyslexic? Are you dyslexic by chance?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's kind of an isolating world, you know? It's kind of an isolating world and a real difficult world, and you found a niche for yourself, a little safety haven. You've kind of embraced your own world by dealing in the financial world and, you know, and keeping that going.
Right.
You're very brave. I'm sure you've trusted enough and gotten wounded enough in life, and you know what it's like? I know what it's like when someone like you reaches out and then gets disappointed by people promising you that it's going to be okay. That must have happened to you a number of times.
Right, but I find my own reserves, in some ways, quite strong.
I think you've done a hell of a job. I can tell you that as isolated you are and as separated as you are, getting a sense of what you grew up with, plus the dyslexia, which is not easy. In fact, worse than not easy. It's kind of a horror to live with, especially with people's attitude towards it, you know. I think you've done kind of marvelously for yourself. I welcome your extension into the outside world by calling me. I welcome it, but I know that you're doing the best you can for yourself. You know, I don't think I have anything but more encouragement of you following your own path, because I have a feeling that you're following your own healing path, you know what I mean? You're fixing yourself. And it may take a little time, but I trust what you're doing is right.
Thank you.
Sure.
Okay.
This is Armand DeMille. Would you give me this number on the air, Matthew? Is that possible while we have call-ins, or is that not possible? Okay, well, I'll talk for a minute. I'm calling David. David, I want you to get ready to be on the air. Gee, I wish that last caller stayed on. I had a question for her. Okay. This is, when you talk about what it's like to be brought up in a performance world, there are certain aspects of it, especially when there's anything that looks like a handicap, you know? Or anything, you just can't do it right, like a speech stutter or something like that. Let me see. I have one friend on the air who I was talking to. I talked to over the last couple of weeks. Let's see if he's there. Is he answering? Nope. David? Let's see.
This is 899.
How do you like that? He's not there. He might have actually been there and just screening his calls, for all I know. But that was David. And I'm going to get him on the show next week because I want to talk about what he lived through and what I've learned about dyslexia since. Okay, let's get another caller on here. Hi, this is Armand DeMille with you. Hello? Hello? Next? Hi there, you're on the air.
Armand?
Yes!
Oh my God, I got through!
Hey!
Believe it.
Happy March.
Oh, yes, you too.
March is my month. I'm going to be 55 years old this month. 5'5". I've waited for a long time. I love the number. I love it. I like it. I've always admired the number 5. I see two big fives coming up. March 14th. March is my month, and 55 is finally here. Half a life.
Well, it might be less than half a life.
It might be less than half a life. It may be half a loaf.
Yeah, well, before I say anything, I want to say hello to my friend David.
Uh-huh.
Because he's listening also.
Good.
I just find it's incredible, the series that you're doing about narcissism.
Why do you want to say hello to David?
Excuse me?
Why do you want to say hello to David? You like him?
Yeah, we're good friends.
David is a good friend?
Yeah.
What is the one thing you would say to David that you might not say to David normally that you would say across the airways through the satellite here at WBAI? What is the one? Oh, no. Wrong David. Matthew, you know what I need? Oh, did we lose a caller?
No, I'm still here.
Do we have... excuse me a second. Okay. I had to whisper off air. I like that. Okay, now, David, you liked it. What's your name?
Gail.
Gail, David's a good friend, right?
Mm-hmm.
I want you to say one phrase to David that you don't normally tell him, but I want you to say it so it kind of goes up to the heavens around where that basket is and gets spread across the universe. Say it right now. David?
David, you're doing it. You're doing exactly what you're supposed to be doing.
Sounded like his mother was talking.
Oh, God!
Out of heaven, you're doing exactly what you're... what you're supposed to be doing. Tell him how you feel towards him. Go ahead.
I feel you're an incredible person.
No, that's what you perceive.
That's what I perceive.
What do you feel?
I feel really warm and connected.
Okay, you feel warm and connected with David, right? That means you like him?
Yeah.
Can you say, I like you a lot, David?
I like you a lot, David.
Say it again.
I like you a lot, David.
Say it again and even louder.
I like you a lot, David.
Okay, David, thank you very much. That was very nice. I just wanted to put that out in the air for all the Davids who are out there. It's March and it's David's Day. Hi there. Okay, how can I help you?
Well, I was thinking about my own narcissistic.
Uh-huh.
And God, there's so many.
Uh-huh, they happen easily, huh?
Oh, my God. But one that comes to mind.
Oh, voice just left.
Which voice?
Yours did. Try again. Are you on a radio phone?
No, I'm not.
Okay, try again. The one that you remember.
Okay, it was pretty recently.
Mm-hmm.
It was a friend that I was friends with for about 5 years, and we used to share a lot of knowledge together. Things that I learned, things that she learned, and we felt we were, or I felt at least, that we were sharing and helping each other grow. One day, she turns around and she tells me that she understood what my problem was and that she didn't want to have anything to do with me anymore.
Yeah, you must have heard her.
Oh, God, it really hurt me.
Okay, but let's go back a step now.
Okay.
When somebody does that, cuts off all things of their relationship, here's what's happening. They are living a certain image, life of their own. They are relating to you. You said something to her that cut through her shield and wounded her. That's what I'm trying to explain to you. You see, when they do that, you have to understand, oh my God, they were wounded. It's like, and I tell this to all of you who are vendors out there, when your customers go away and they don't come back, you've wounded them. You've wounded them in some way. By ignoring them, by not returning a call, or something like that. What do you imagine took place right before she did that? Right before she told you that? Was there any discussion that you had with her? Was there any bit of truth that you shared with her? Is there anything that you did, or any anger you expressed towards her, right before she told you that?
Yeah, there was.
Tell me about it.
It was her and I and two other women.
Uh-huh.
She just heard from one of the women something very nasty that really hurt her. And she wanted to work it through.
Yeah.
And in the presence of the two other women, that whole game going on, that I didn't feel it was a safe place to do it.
Yeah.
And I kind of pulled away.
You backed out. She needed you at the moment. She wanted to prove that she was right. She was on shaky ground because somebody had said something about her that was shaking her skin, right?
Right.
In other words, her narcissistic wound happened before you. She turns to you and says, look, I'm falling apart. My image self is falling apart. Will you give me some glue to hold it together? And you looked at it and said, ooh, I don't like this very much. I don't like this game very much. No, I will not do that for the moment. And so she lumped you into the category of those who in some way hurt her, wounded her.
Well, she said it was me.
Yeah, I understand. I understand. So the wound took place and you wouldn't patch her up. And the wound was so deep for not patching her up, she saw that as a betrayal, that she decided she would not face the fact that she was desperate. Desperate to keep herself looking a certain way. And probably whatever was said about her, let's watch this one.
What was said?
Yeah, the thing that was said about her was probably true. What was the vicious thing that was said about her?
What?
What was the rumor that was said about her?
Somebody was stealing from
her. That one of the people she knows?
One of the two people that were there with us was stealing from
her. Was stealing from us. So she had to confront the fact that she was not loved. See? And she's looking for love desperately. When somebody steals from you, you know they ain't loving you. And that hurts. And then when you turn to somebody else to back you up in some way and they don't back you up, that hurts. So this lady felt a big, big hurt. And then she turns around to you and just cuts you off. And that's what people who are wounded narcissistically do. They cut you off. So that's what you have to understand. Her image self was damaged. Her image about herself was damaged. Rather than face the fact that she was not really lovable, that she really was not loved, that all her manipulations were not working, that people were really not caring for her the way they should, rather than face that, she'd rather reject you and the other friends. You know?
That still hurts.
I know it hurts you, sure. And you haven't recovered, right?
Well, what I found out about a month later... because we did a lot of work together, I found an ad when she was going to the workshop on the stuff that I taught her.
Yeah.
And that really... So taken aback. I was in shock.
And that really hurt because now somebody was stealing from you and the stuff that you identify as yours, the knowledge and wisdom that is yours. Do you own this knowledge and wisdom?
No. It's for everybody.
Uh-huh.
And I'm all for sharing.
Yeah.
But, you know, I felt like I was thrown away.
So here's what you're dealing with, okay? You are dealing with your image of yourself. You're dealing with the fact that people should love you and nobody should throw you away, that what you have is precious and that you should hold on to it and people should give you recognition. And you're in a desperate search, and I don't mean desperate too much because I think you sound like a very nice person who's gone a long way. You're in a desperate search to kind of hold on to the image of yourself. And I wonder what it's like when all that pain, when all that image stuff kind of disappears, what you're really like. And that's why you're holding on to the pain. See? I get copied all the time. I could write things or say things on the air that I hear appearing on somebody else's radio show as a brand new theory.
So I
think it's a compliment because they don't have to give me credit because, you know, I'm glad somebody thought it was nice.
When someone lets the pain go away, I mean, what is the process? How can you let that pain go away? How can you let go of that?
You judged wrong. Did you know that? Do you know that you're hungry for people to love you? Do you know that? Do you know that?
No.
Oh, I didn't hear your answer.
Yeah.
It's hunger.
I always want people, you know, like me, love me.
And admire you.
Yeah.
Right? So that's a trap. See, we're caught in that. When you're caught in that place where you need it, then you're very vulnerable to the wounds. It's nice to be loved. It's nice to be cared for. But needing, desperately needing to fill kind of an empty hole from childhood, that leaves you vulnerable to these wounds. So the only thing I say to you is if you find yourself holding on for a long time, you ask yourself, how did this wound my image of myself as a lovable person? That's the question you ask yourself. Because really, you know, I mean, kind of all the things you're doing to get all this affection out there, it works sometimes, but then it's not always going to work, and people, you're going to feel the pain. So, I don't know if that makes you feel better. Here's something I discovered recently. Listen to this. You know, you talk about the need to be loved. We were trying to figure out, a couple of friends of mine and I were trying to figure out why Prozac works. Why does Prozac take a depressed person, right? Two people it takes. Obsessive compulsive disorder and depression. Now, mind you, I'm talking from my shrink head. I am the director of a mental health clinic. I have been doing therapy for 25 years. I hang out with a lot of people in the mental health profession. And Prozac, as you know, has got mixed reviews, right? I don't like to see people on any medication. But why does Prozac work so well? So much so that I saw somebody wearing a t-shirt that said Prozac recently, because he was communicating with other people who take Prozac. There's so many people out there, like the old Valium. Prozac works because it desensitizes, get this, this is radical new information out there, desensitizes the felt memory of the past. Felt memory. That means you could think back to the past when you were a kid and you could remember your mother being nice to you or your mother making a cake or something. You could remember it. Also, everybody is capable of feeling things from the past. You can recapture the feeling. You can actually bring back the feeling to yourself. Prozac helps you eliminate the feeling of the past but still keep the memory. It kind of cuts off a little neural mechanism that makes you have the memory without the feeling. So, in effect, it severs the sensory cord, the feeling cord to your childhood. So you don't remember pain. And since the pain of not being loved is the biggest pain, Prozac separates you from the need for pain. The need for love. I'm sorry. It also separates you from all memory of even pleasurable things from childhood. But it's magic, because then you can think about obsessive compulsive disorder, you know? Why are people doing obsessive compulsive things, getting things in order, hand washing, getting everything tidied up? Because as kids they were told they wouldn't be loved unless they got their hands clean, because they wouldn't be loved unless they got things neat, and they're kind of compulsively acting this out. Prozac takes away the pain of that memory. So therefore, you know, and there's one further evidence, which is about the fact that it removes the need for love. Prozac lowers sexual desire, too. People who take Prozac become sexually disinterested, for most people do, because sex is related to getting love for a lot of people. So Prozac dulls the sense memories, and you can remember the past, but you can't feel the feelings of the past, so you lose the pain, and you lose the pleasure of childhood as well. And that's why Prozacians tend to be a little lifeless, you know, because the child is dead. That's one way to go. Not my way. I hope not your way. Some of you I know who are taking Prozac, but it's that dull feeling. That's kind of how it works. It kind of kills the narcissistic need to be loved. Interesting theory, at least. That's kind of as far as we've gone with it. Let's take one more caller. Hi there, this is Armand Amelia on the air.
Yeah, I've been in a crazy business. 20 years. I had every diagnosis, been on every medication, finally found the right doctor and the right medication, and,
You know, I'm sorry, your voice is fading in and out. I wish it could. I wish I could get you on the air. Call back and turn your radio down when you do. Just one more thing so I can get this in here today. I want to talk a little bit about the depression that goes along with narcissism. You know, I want to make a mention of it. You either become grandiose and you get out there and you're trying to get people to love you by being a performer of some sort or other, you know, or you give up trying to be loved. You develop a belief that no matter what you do, nobody will ever really love you for who you are. And therefore, you get depressed. So depression, as well as being a lot of things, is very specifically the belief that no one will ever love you. That no matter what you do, no one will ever love you, that you're not good enough to love. That's also one of the narcissistic adjustments. Next week when we meet, and we'll still be here for a while, next week I'm going to try to cover some of the things you could do to reclaim the natural feeling self away from this narcissistic image. I hope this tape series has been, or the last three shows have been of interest to you, because they're fascinating to me. The subject is fascinating to me. Strongly recommend you pick up Alice Miller's book, The Drama of the Gifted Child, the revised edition. And if you want copies of this show or the last two shows, you can call my office, because we're producing them on tape. And that number is 212-757-4488. That's 212-757-4488. So mainly, I've kind of wanted to go through this. I wanted to get David. Next week, we'll get someone else on. Let's see, 2793400. We have time for another caller. Let's take another caller. You're on the air there. Hi there. This is Armand DeMille.
Hello, hi. Armand. I've listened to you for a number of years, but I've never called in.
Oh, hi there. What's your name?
Dana. My name is Dana.
Dana, hi there.
Hi.
Is Dana your real name?
Dana is my real name.
Good. Hi there.
I sort of had played around with the idea of changing it.
I know. That's what I heard. What were you going to change it to?
I really don't know. Mary.
Well, Mary, what did your mother call you when you were a kid?
Dinala.
Dinala?
Yeah.
D-I-N-A-L-A?
No. D-I-N-E-L-E.
E-I-N-E-L-E. Inala.
Yeah.
Okay. And your name now is, did you say Dana?
D-E-N-A.
E-A-N-A. Ina.
D-E-N-A.
I'm doing wrong. I'm missing something. What's happening? What's this? D-E-N-A. Dina. Dina. Okay. Dina. And your mother called you Dinala. And you're thinking of changing your name to Mary?
I'm just kidding.
Okay. Yeah, but didn't you ever think of changing your name?
No, actually, I had changed my name. It was Diana, and I changed it when I went into high school.
That's what I wanted to know about.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. There's a big difference between Diana and Dana.
That's right.
Right? Tell me the difference between the two.
Well, one of them is an American, you know, it's sort of a Greek goddess name.
Yeah.
And the other one is a Hebrew name. And the daughter of Jacob, who was raped.
Uh-huh. So which one do you want to be?
Well, I'd rather not be the raped daughter, although I was.
Yeah. And so you kind of gave that up, and you try to take your own identity, right, by changing your name. Did it work?
I don't think so.
I don't think so either. It's pretty tough. It's pretty tough to just change your name and have it all happen, you know, but it should be that easy.
Well, no, actually, it was more complicated than that. When I noticed my birth certificate when I was going into high school, and I found my real name on my birth certificate. It was not Diana. It was Dina. So I changed my name to Dina.
Okay, great. All right, let's hear. And why did you call today?
Well, I called today because a long time ago, when I first came to New York to graduate school, after a half year of graduate school, I was told to leave and reapply another time. And I said, I don't think I've ever gotten over it. And I find that a tragedy. There's nothing I can do about it now.
Okay, see, so there you are bopping to New York, and here's a typical example of what I'm talking about. Dana comes to town, and saying, I am ready to take on New York, and I'm going to be good, and I'm going to go to school, I'm going to go to graduate school, and they're going to accept me, and they're going to love me. Now, for one reason or another,
yeah.
Oh, wait a minute, this is more complicated than you're saying. You weren't just rejected because they didn't find you qualified for the school. They rejected you because they thought there was something wrong with you emotionally, didn't they?
They thought I was too hostile.
That's right. Pretty sharp. They thought you were too hostile. In other words, they looked at you. They didn't just do it on academic merit. They saw you and they said, uh-oh, we don't want to take her in. She's too much trouble. And we send you away and we say, no, we're not going to take you in because you're too hostile. And there you are faced with this image of yourself. You go into a place and you think you have a right and you feel this just sense of justice, and they look at you and they say, no, I'm sorry to tell you, we think you're different than you think you are. We think that you're disturbed emotionally and we don't want to take you in. And you got angry at them and it just stuck in your craw.
Yeah, well, I think it's a little bit more complicated than that, because I was highly recommended, You know, I had been
working
as a social worker in Chicago.
I hear.
But anyway.
No, I hear. And, I wish we had more time to discuss it. Maybe we will on the next show. So, you know, here's someone who points out something to you that you certainly didn't want to see and certainly didn't believe, and that's what I mean by a narcissistic wound. It goes right to the soul, and you almost never recover from it. I wish you a lot of luck with it. Next time, next week, next Wednesday at 1 p.m., we'll get back and clean this whole thing up. My best to all of you. Happy March. Bye-bye.
Mm-hmm.